You're listening to Fire Ecology Chats, a podcast series by the Association for Fire Ecology.
Hello, everyone. My name is Bob Keane. I'm the editor-in-chief of the internationally renowned journal Fire Ecology. Fire Ecology is a journal that's published by Springer Nature and overseen by the Association for Fire Ecologists. It's a highly cited journal, and it's going to get even more highly cited when we talk about this paper today. We've got two fun people to talk about the paper Effects of Fire and Fire-Induced Changes in Soil Property on Post-Burn Soil Respiration. We have Dana Johnson and Thea Whitman. Dana, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hello everyone. My name is Dana Johnson. I am a PhD dissertator at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And Thea, you're up.
My name is Thea Whitman, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Soil and Environmental Sciences, also at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, thank you two for your time. I had a really fun time reading this paper. Dana, can you tell us what it's all about?
Yeah, of course. We are studying boreal forest soil carbon cycling. Boreal forests make up a really large portion of northern North America, and these forests store a lot of carbon below ground. So we're interested in how wildfires affect soil carbon cycling. Specifically in this paper, we're linking fire-induced changes in soil properties with changes in soil respiration in the months after fire.
Yeah, it's really important, of course, in the boreal forest because of climate change. Thea, while talking to you before the podcast, there was something happened funny about the methods. Why don't you tell us about the methods and a funny antidote?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe a little bit of background before I get into it. One of the neat things about the study is that we actually used intact soil cores. So as soil scientists, our study system is literally buried. So it's often pretty difficult to observe and manipulate it. And I'd say soil scientists were really notorious for taking a soil sample and then sieving it, where you just completely destroy all the physical structure and spatial relationships. And so in this study, we were working with intact soil cores. So we kind of took this middle ground. We are preserving the physical relationships within the core, but we're also bringing them into the lab. The downside, of course, is that we have some of the heterogeneity from the field, so the data are variable, but of course, that's reflecting what's going on in the real world. So as we were bringing these cores back to Wisconsin, we had our tubs, but we had those intact soil cores all stored in, ready to ship them off, got all our permitting in place, got to the airport, and I had already gone through security, and then I looked back, and I noticed that Dana hadn't followed. So I go over to the security lineup, which is pretty short, usually, in Yellowknife, and Dana's there, and something's going on, and we had to figure out, okay, so what's happening? And they had flagged that you actually can't, as it turns out, take basically more than a pop can's worth of sandy or salt-like material on your carry-on. Perfectly fine if this is in your checked luggage, but we had a few extra cores that we couldn't fit into the totes that we had checked, so we just threw them into the carry-on thinking it'd be fine. And yeah, it turns out it is a forbidden substance to have in your carry-on in Canada. So we were sort of in this frantic, you know, the plane's about to board. We couldn't take our luggage off to put the carry-on bag cores into the checked bags. And also on this trip, I had my one-year-old son with me. So what ended up happening is I was like, you know, these samples are too precious. We can't let them go. We can't discard them. I'm going to stay behind. Plane's boarding. I'll take the course. I'm kind of throwing my son across security to my husband, passing our passports around and then saying bye to the research team. I'm going to get home somewhere or other with these cores. You guys go ahead. Did manage to make it home within, I think, 36 hours, and the cores eventually made it. So long story short, if you're traveling in Canada on an airplane, do not bring sandy soils into your carry-ons.
I must remember that next time I'm collecting soil in the boreal. Yep. Thanks for that. Dana, what are the major findings for this paper?
Yeah, so burning reduces the total soil carbon due to combustion, but with it, we see reductions in total CO2 fluxes. However, what's really interesting in this study is that if you consider the CO2 fluxes on a per gram of remaining carbon basis, the carbon that remains is actually being decomposed more slowly in the burned soils. And the changes that we measure in soil properties like pH and carbon to nitrogen ratios in the burned soils don't easily explain the decreased respiration that we're measuring. So one clue to what might be happening is that when we fit these simple two-pool decay models to our soil CO2 flux data, they indicate that the slowly decomposing carbon pool is getting bigger as a proportion of the total carbon after the burn. And this might be due to the production of slow cycling pyrogenic or fire-affected organic matter. We also found that the decomposition rate of the faster cycling carbon pool gets faster with fire, which might be due to the release of easily decomposable carbon from killed plants and microbes. This raises some really interesting questions about what the net effects of fire will be on soil fluxes long term? And how long would this slower decomposition persist? Also, is it enough to offset carbon losses due to combustion to any meaningful extent? Which are all questions that we're going to be asking in future work.
Yeah, it's really a great paper for that. I have a computer model and I looked at this paper and immediately started reassigning values in my computer model so we could model soil respiration a little better. What would be the other major findings that people could use out of this paper, Thea?
Yeah, I mean, I think really just from this carbon management perspective, these findings highlight that we shouldn't just be thinking about how much carbon is lost through combustion during the burn, but really what happens to the carbon that's left behind? Does it decompose more slowly? Does that stick around? How long does that effect last? And I think there's some really interesting future work that could start to address those questions.
Sure is. Thanks a lot for that. Dana, what do you think is next? I know this is only one part of your PhD dissertation. Tell us, what do you think is going to happen next?
Yeah, this paper is covering one part of an experimental study that had multiple dimensions. And so next, I'm really interested in understanding how burning is affecting soil microbial community function and how that interacts with changes in soil properties to affect post-fire carbon cycling. So I've been working on a paper that will hopefully be out soon looking at burn-induced changes in microbial carbon use efficiency, which I'm really excited about. We're getting some really interesting results there. And then I've been taking some of that work and integrating it into a soil organic matter model to try and model post-fire soil carbon fluxes, which I think will really help us understand what's happening with these really large carbon reservoirs in boreal forests. Super excited to share that work with you in the future.
Yeah, that's great. Very, very interesting stuff. Thea, would you like to recognize co-authors and funding agencies?
Yeah, definitely. So first, I guess a big thanks to our co-authors, in particular, Carrie Yedinek and Keith Warren, are scientists at the USDA Forest Products Lab, which is actually based here in Wisconsin. And one of the awesome things about working with real fire scientists is that instead of just doing a burn, we lit our soil on fire. Okay, we did a burn study. We actually use their expertise to make sure that the fire simulations that we do are ecologically realistic. So the effects that we measure are actually going to mean something in the context of the real world. Thanks to Ben Solman, who's a scientist at Oak Ridge National Lab, who really has been helping us on the modeling side of things. And then Tim Berry is a research scientist in our group who built this awesome machine we have that we call the multiplexer that allows us to automatically sample 56 different mason jars at once for CO2 fluxes. And Kelsey Kruger, who was the research technician in our lab at the time and really helped the field campaign and also lab work. Funding for this came from the U.S. Department of Energy, the Biological Environmental Research Environmental System Sciences Program. And then we also would be remiss if we didn't give a huge thanks to everybody at Wood Buffalo National Park, where we were conducting this research.
Thanks so much, you two, for telling us all about this very interesting paper. Thank you for your time. And for those of you listening, if you like this topic and want to read the paper, guess what? It's available for free at our journal website. You can download the PDF or read it right on the website at your leisure. Dana has already paid the freight, so you can go ahead and read it for free. Until next time, when we do another fire ecology chat, I'd like to bid you adieu and hope all your efforts in fire ecology pay off. This is Bob Keane signing off.
Thank you for listening to Fire Ecology Chats, a podcast series by the Association for Fire Ecology. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to our show and leave us a review. To learn more about fire ecology and support our future work by becoming a member, visit fireecology.org. FIRECOLOGY.org.